Okay, I haven't normally told you to do this, but go ahead and turn back in your folders to page 4. I know we've been referencing this every time we've been having class, but since we've been off for a few weeks, I think it's good if we actually look at this. I do have copies of the lesson today. You might not have a copy of the sheet. I can bring you one if you don't have one. I forgot to mention that earlier. Okay. On page 4, this, of course, is our outline, and we've already worked through the first 3 points that are sort of grayed out on the screen. But we're in the monologue section of the book, as we remember. This is by far the largest section, and we're at the fourth bullet under that sort of heading, as we have the book divided up and outlined. Solomon has led us in his search, how he tried to find life's meaning unsuccessfully. Then he talked about some problems in life, though he never, as we know, hesitated to admit that God is sovereign and he rules life. That's never been a doubt in his mind, nor should it be in ours either. But he did say, despite that, we see some of these problems. I'm trying to harmonize problems in life with this complete rule of God. Looked at the application section, where he tried to explain and apply the sovereign wisdom of God in situations. And now we're in this last main section that began at chapter 8, verse 16. Will take us through chapter 12 and verse 8, where we are reminded in many different ways to trust God, learn to have faith in Him and His wisdom, and try our best to live as joyfully and thankfully as we can, even though the world is uncertain and often, I don't want to say forces us, but exposes us to its puzzles and its paradoxes. So this, of course, is the section we're in right now, this last one right here. And we're in the middle of this section, if you will. And chapter 10, 1 through 20, we looked at, and this is the major section of this subsection, if you will. And again, as you see on page 19, that in that black box, this uncertain world should not prevent us from doing certain things that are being discussed in this last section. And this one is that, you know, we have foolishness in the world, and sometimes we can act foolishly, or men in general act foolishly. And even though the world is uncertain, and it is, that still should not keep us from shunning or staying away from that which is foolish. And as we remember, the chapter began, the proverbial way that he begins this, dead flies make a perfumer's oil stink, my version reads, and so a little foolishness is weightier than wisdom and honor. How much does it take of a little of a bad thing to ruin a whole lot of a good thing? Not much. Not much at all. And we talked about that some a few weeks ago. Even a little folly can ruin a valuable thing. Excuse me, something that he had taught previously in the ninth chapter, we remember that. And we talked about, you know, the comparison here of the oil in the days of the ancients, perfume and oil were costly, valuable things. In our days, I think the application would be, you know, godly character, reputation. It takes a lot to build those. It takes many years to build a valuable name and character and reputation. How quickly can it be destroyed? Just fast, so fast, with just a little bit of foolishness and dishonor. So that's the wisdom, I think, that Solomon was teaching us here. He talked about the ways of the wise and the fool, verses 2 through 3, and again, biblically speaking, you'll see there in verse 2, which way is for which person, the right and the left is for which one. Always in Scripture. Who goes to the left? It's the fool. Who goes to the right? It's always the wise man. So Solomon repeats that biblical theme, if you will. The wise man's heart always leads to the right. The fool's heart always leads him to the left. And even the foolishness of the fool is obvious to all. He gets out here and just conducts himself in his normal affairs, and anybody who sees him, oh, that's a fool. They can tell by the way he carries himself, by how he talks, how he walks, how he interacts with others. They all see that he's lacking in sense. And that's a biblical phrase that I think that at least used in some of the translations of this chapter. And his senseless actions are exposed by his character is exposed by his senseless actions. He then talked about in verse 4 the value of what we call wise composure. You remember there in verse 4, he talked about a foolish ruler. If the ruler's temper rises against you, what did he say not to do? Yeah, don't leave your position. Don't try to fight fire with fire. Don't try to outfool the king. Because as he had said earlier in chapter 8, what position is the king in relative to his subjects? Yeah, that's right. Since he's over everybody else, and he can do what he wants. And if you kind of get silly and crazy about things and you try to go against the king, you may be cutting off your nose to spite your face, as the old saying goes. You may be doing yourself more harm than good. So he says, don't abandon your position. Be calm. It allays great offenses. We talked about all that. And we gave an example when class ended a few weeks ago. This was in question 16. Those passages in Matthew 10 and Acts chapter 4. Remember what Jesus told the apostles. This was, of course, way before his death. He said, you'll be brought before kings and councils. And he said, try to give them some calmness. What did he tell them? Don't worry about what? Yeah, don't worry about what you shall say, because it will be given you what you shall say before those tribunals and those councils. And in Acts chapter 4, we saw that sort of fulfilled, didn't we? When first it was just Peter and John, and then all the apostles were brought before the council. And how calm were those men? They're very calm. In fact, the record says the council realized they had what? Been with Jesus. They saw their confidence. So here were these unlearned fishermen. Most of them were fishermen. Tax collector here or there and so forth. A zealot, if you will. But most of them were uneducated men who had not been taught the skill of reason and debate as the council had been, the Pharisees. But we see that very thing played out in the first century by the apostles. And so that kind of gets us back to where we were talking about, at least through verse 4 of chapter 10. And again, that's question 16 on page 21. So here's where we pick up now as we left off last time. Now, I think he's giving us more illustration of the evil actions of foolishness, verses 5 through 7. Solomon says, there is an evil I have seen under the sun, like an error which goes forth from the ruler. So I think we're still talking about unwise decisions by a monarch or a king or a ruler. Folly is set, this is verse 6, folly is set in many exalted places, while rich men sit in humble places. I have seen slaves riding on horses and princes walking like slaves on the land. This is sort of like a previous section we had where Solomon said, you know, in our culture or in society, sometimes things are backwards. Things aren't as they would normally, as we would think they would need to be, is what I'm trying to say. And here's how I think he's talking about this. Sometimes folly is set forth in exalted places, isn't it? While wisdom is forced into humble places. And I think this section here, verses 5 through 7, and to me, chapter 10 of Ecclesiastes has a lot of, how can I put this, politically practical things that we can talk about. Especially these three verses, and then we get down here through verses 16 through 20, that to me have a lot of very practical, present-day application. We can see the wisdom of the Scripture in that way. Is it so that sometimes a foolish man rises to political prominence? I wish that wasn't so, but it's so. Well, we have, whether it's on a local level or a state level or even the national level. And just everything is at their beck and call. They're in that position of prominence now. And then what about those who are wiser than they are? Well, to what place are they subjected? To the low or the humble places. Now, a fool can be brought to power. What happens if he's not grounded enough? What's going to go to his head? And that's just such an easy temptation to fall into. And I think what he's saying here is that he even makes some ill-wise appointments. A fool will appoint another fool to an important task. I'm not trying to mischaracterize any ruler, president, governor, mayor, councilman, whatever. I'm just making some general statements here. But look at the examples that he's given, especially there in verse 7. What was What was an outward sign of political favor that was in the Bible days, whether the Old or the New Testament, especially the Old Testament, based on verse 7? Yeah, if you had a person leading someone on a horse, that obviously who had the honor? Well, not the one walking the horse, it'd be the one that was riding the horse. And in fact, in some biblical accounts, and I'm put one up here on the screen. In fact, did I put it in the question? Yeah, question 17. Someone was given an honor if they said, "Put him on the king's horse." I mean, that's not just riding any old horse, not some horse from the barn, but like a plow horse, but the king's horse. That was an honor, and the one who led him about, he was the slave. He was the servant, and the one who was in the saddle was the one who was receiving the honor. So, as we further develop this thought, sometimes he says the wrong person is in the saddle and the wrong person is leading the horse. It needs to be the other way around. But that's not how it is in our culture sometimes, just the way some things work out. See, that's the uncertain part of this world, and we can't get so wrapped up in that we just throw up our hands and say, well, we're just all so despondent now. It's just all gone crazy. There's no rhyme or reason for anything. A biblical example, we won't read all 12 of these verses, but you know the story of Esther. Remember and we're sort of jumping in here at the middle, but who was the villain of the story of Esther, if I can use that word? Haman was the bad guy. And by this time in chapter 6, he had already concocted what scheme before chapter 6? That's right. We're going to wipe out, exterminate, kill off all the Jews. And you remember why he made that decision? All because of one man, Mordecai. Because Mordecai wouldn't give him the honor that he thought he deserved. I'm not just going to kill him, I'm going to kill all his people. Well, Mordecai, and to a larger extent, God, sort of had a ace up the sleeve. Who was in the palace? Esther. And what had she not done at the start? Mordecai said what? That's right. Don't tell anybody who you are. You keep your ethnicity quiet. But he played that card at the right time. And, of course, we know how the book turns out. That was by divine providence. But having said all that, getting in the story at that place, Haman wants to honor himself, and so he goes to the king for further elements of his plan. But the king was working on something too. Remember, he couldn't sleep one night, and he said, "Bring me the royal records." And Mordecai had done something, hadn't he? That was written in the record. What had he done? He had uncovered this plot. These assassins were going to kill the king, and Mordecai had found them out, and that had gotten written in the records, as it should have been. That needed to be recorded. And the king obviously did not know that when it was read to him. Well, his first thought was, we got to honor this man. I mean, he saved the crown. So it's sort of a little funny how all the timing of this thing worked out. When he's concluding in his mind, we've got to honor this man. An advisor says to the king, "Well, Haman's out there in the hallway. He wants to speak to you." And he brings Haman in because Haman was an advisor. And the king asked Haman a question. Remember what it was? What shall be done to the man whom the king desires to honor? Now he didn't tell him why. He didn't say, "Haman, I just read in the records where someone saved my life. Now, what do you think?" He just said, "What?" It was just a general question. What shall be done to the man whom the king desires to honor? What did Haman think? Well, who would he want to honor more than me? He was so full of himself. So, remember what Haman said? What was his answer? Put him on the king's horse. Let him have a runner, if you will, to lead the horse throughout the city, claiming and shouting, "Thus and so it shall be done to the one whom the king wants to honor." Of course, who did Haman think was going to be saddled? It wasn't going to be him. And did the king like Haman's answer? Yeah, that's a good answer. Go get my horse, put Mordecai on it, and by the way, Haman, you're going to lead him about. So you call that some divine justice, don't you? Didn't work out for Haman the way that it did. Now, of course, it worked out the way it was supposed to in that case, but this is an example of that of that very thing. As far as Haman wanted to work out, who would have been in the saddle, the wise man or the fool? It would have been the fool. And the wise man would have been leading the wrong person about, but as it turned out, it worked out the way it was supposed to. Yeah. Yes. Yeah, I mean, he would. There are those who will wiggle themselves in and put themselves. I mean, a lot of people are very, very politically savvy, aren't they? I mean, they know. They play the game well. Not to digress a whole lot, but I think it sort of fits here. What our government needs is a lot of godly people in it, doesn't it? But is it wise for a Christian to be involved in government? I don't think so. The corruption that's there is just so pervasive and so overwhelming. It would not impossible, but it would just be so hard to, first off, remain faithful yourself, and secondly, to do any amount of good. But that's exactly what our government needs, whether it's the local government, the state government, or the national government. It'd be tough. So I think you're right, Ralph. How he always got in those situations. The Bible is silent about that, but we can see the kind of character he was. It's not hard to imagine how that played itself out. So I thought of this story from Esther. It's not exactly what Solomon is saying, but if Haman got his way, it would have been this way. But God worked it out to be the other way around. Well, he did, and they got used on him, didn't they? Not Mordecai, but the gallows hung Haman. Okay. So, just sort of some practical statements, at least through verse 7. Now I'm going to go to the top of page 22, and if you'll look at starting at question 18, the question is, what should be considered before taking any action? Keep in mind that in this chapter, I think there's a lot of disconnected subjects that he just kind of goes from one to the other. And wisdom literature, which of course this book is to me, it's more practical and should be thought of that way than just textual. It has like this constant theme that goes through a chapter. Sometimes the inspired writer just would put a lot of subjects back to back to back, but they all have a practical aspect to them. And I think that's the case here. As we jump from talking about some political applications through verse 7 to more practical here, that this could be applied in any given situation. What does he tell us about verses 8 through 9 in terms of being practical, being cautious? That's a good way to put that, Brother Lambert. In any activity, are there some inherent dangers? Some more than others, but in any activity, generally speaking, there are some dangers that we need to be aware of, be cautious about, be careful so that we don't fall victim to that. Even through our own foolishness, we still have to be aware of that. Even in everyday activities. Success or failure might be determined by how careful or observant one is in those activities. What does he mention in verses 8 through 9 as some examples? What about the first part of verse 8? All right. You dig a hole, you dig a pit for some reason. All right. Whether it's burying something or maybe digging a well or whatever the reason would be for digging this pit. But what's the inherent danger? I mean, you got to dig the pit, but you could fall in, that's right, and injure yourself. The last part of verse 8 has given some a little bit of a problem. I don't know if we can exactly say for sure what's in store here. But what is the thing that he mentions in verse 8? Yeah. Now, we can't control where serpents and snakes go. They're going to go where they go. But if you happen, and just through accident, maybe you're tearing a wall out to enlarge something, or maybe in the hole that you're digging, you're trying to make the hole bigger, and through that wall of dirt, you're trying to dig it out more. Well, you don't know there's hidden danger. There's things in there that, if you're not careful, you could reach through the wall to further pull it out, and a snake bite you. Right, yeah. That's the present day example of the very same thing he's talking about here. So, caution, prudence is always necessary when you're dealing in activities like this. Fools, as a general rule, don't pay attention. They're just going along, not looking at anything around them. They act without regard to dangers. And these would even be dangers that are beyond their control. I mean, things happen. But the wise man, the cautious man will say, well, you know, this, not that it would, but this could happen. And so I need to be prepared for that kind of, that very thing. So, another example, verse 9, he who quarries stones, well, that's a dangerous job. I've never done that before, but we can see the danger in that, can be hurt by them. What about he who splits logs? Sometimes what even happens to the axe head? They fly off the handle, and through no fault of even the most careful wood splitter, things can happen. But the fool just doesn't think along those lines. And so the wisdom here is, you know, we can, the world is uncertain, yes, but we can still shun foolishness, stay away from it when we show some caution and some prudence in everyday activities. Now look at verses 10 through 11. And more practical wisdom. Wisdom or foolishness is shown by how one performs chosen activities. And there's two different ones that he lists here. In verse 10, what is the activity that's going on? Sort of like what we just said in verse 9. All right, splitting wood, chopping wood with a dull axe. Now, let's say you start. You get up early, the log splitter gets up early one morning and he's sharpened his blade and he's got a whole day's worth of wood to split. Well, okay, he gets at it and he's really cutting wood to beat the band, as they might say. Well, what happens eventually? The axe is going to get dull. Why? Well, just because it's being used. So, the fool says, I've got all this wood to split and it's going to take me the whole day to do it, so I'm just going to keep on working. Well, what's the problem with that? It's going to get harder because the edge of the blade or the axe head is dull. Now, the wise man knows the smart thing to do is what? Stop splitting wood and sharpen the blade again. But the fool says, I can't stop. I got too much wood to split. So we see the difference. And we've had a modern-day equivalent. You know, don't just work harder, work smarter. Wouldn't it take less time to stop splitting and sharpen the blade than to keep on working and cut with a dull? Obviously it would. And so we see that's the biblical example of that very thing that we sometimes use ourselves. To work foolishly requires, like Solomon says, you'll exert more energy. And if you just stop for a minute, sharpen the blade, and then get back to work again. All right, verse 11, what's the second activity that he mentions? And this is something that is a biblical example. Yeah, snake charming. I've never seen a snake charmer before. I've seen some in cartoons, maybe, but never a real live one. But those who would charm snakes, well, whatever the ins and outs of that profession were, it was for the purpose of grabbing or holding on to the snake. But the charmer was trying to do what first? Hypnotize or charm the snake so that what wouldn't happen? I mean, that's right. When a snake's serpent is going to bite. So the timing is everything that he's emphasizing here. It's when to act is critical. Now, what if a person has the best snake charming skills in the world? I don't know how you would determine that, but let's say he's been deemed the best snake charmer. But how would he even act foolishly? What if he possesses this skill? How would he waste it? If he acts too soon, if he tries to grab a snake before he even charms the snake. And so, pardon? Yeah, the snake's going to grab him instead. So what Solomon is saying here is that one shows his wisdom or his foolishness, even if he possesses a certain skill to do a certain activity, if he acts too soon, if he doesn't let the skill take effect in what he's doing, he'll wind up doing himself more harm than he'll do good. Now, that's true not just about snake charming, but about any activity. But that's the one that Solomon mentions here in the text. And we can apply that same principle. So if you want to be wise or foolish regarding this very principle here, then know when it is the right time to employ the skill rather than acting too soon or too hasty, and then it'll wind up being a foolish decision for you. Well, I would agree. I wouldn't advise charming snakes in the first place, but the point is the same. I think you're right. Well, he talked about charming, not killing the snake. So let's stay with the text here. Okay. So the point is, an uncertain world can neutralize a great skill, whatever the skill is. And I'm using that word neutralize, if one is not wise regarding knowing when to employ that skill. And I think that's really the point we want to take from, at least through verse 11. And that gets us through question 20. Okay, any other comments or thoughts, questions? All right, look now at question 21. And let's read now together verses 12 through the first sentence of verse 14. 12 through the first part of verse 14. Paul, if you read those verses for us, please. There you go, right there. Stop right there. All right. So now we're talking about speech, how one would talk. Wisdom or foolishness, again, in this overall section here, it's evidenced by one's actions. We've been talking about that. Now it's also evidenced by one's speech. All right. How does Solomon describe the wise man's talk and the foolish man's talk? Who does he talk? Who does he start with in verse 12? All right. Angela, what does he say about the wise man's speech? Did your version say favor? All right. Paul read from the King James, it was graciousness, or his words are gracious. All right. Gracious. All right. So the wise man's speech, or the wise man, or the wise people speak gracious words, don't they? Let's look at a couple of New Testament passages here. Turn with me to Luke chapter 4. I think I put these actually in the question, didn't I? Yeah, it's question 21. Luke chapter 4. I only have verse 22 on the lesson sheet, but let's look at verses 16 through 22. Luke chapter 4. Ms. Shirley, when you have that, would you read Luke 4 for us, verses 16 through 22? All right, thank you. So we're focusing on verse 22, but the context was Jesus stood up to read, and then his application was there in verse 21. What I've just read, it's been fulfilled today in your hearing. And they were just astonished at that. And as Luke writes it, what was it that astonished them? He's the example of what Solomon's saying right here. The graciousness of his words. That's the Lord. Now turn to Colossians chapter 4. Let's read verse 6, Colossians, the fourth chapter. This is addressed to me and you, to saints. Let's start in verse 5. Read verses 5 and 6. Paul says, "Walk in wisdom toward those who are outside," that is to say, outside the body of Christ, "redeeming the time," or making the most of opportunities. "Let your speech always be with grace, seasoned as it were with salt, so that what? You will know how to answer every man." So the things that Solomon is saying here, that's what the New Testament teaches. If we truly want to be wise, men and women, wise people. It's not just our actions, but what comes out of our mouths. And so he says the wise will speak gracious words. Now, by contrast, what does he say? The lips of the fool do what? They consume him. Some versions say the fool is destroyed or he's swallowed up by his own lips. Would it be fair to say that the talk of the foolish man is self-destructive? Isn't that what he's saying? I think that's exactly what he's saying. Look also at... how was he further described in verse 13? With respect to... And this is the fool, not the wise man. Verse 13. All right. He says... He writes, the beginning of his talk is folly, and the end of it is wicked madness. So what do you get from start to finish? There's nothing in the wise man's speech that's of any value. You can't say, well, he started out pitiful. He said a few things good here or there, and then the end. No, it's all terrible. It's not good, any of it. And why is that? Because all he knows is foolishness. He's not grounded. He's not trying to live by a higher code, if you will. So it's worthless from beginning to end. Hit the wrong button there. And the fool thinks the more he says, the better. Right? Look at verse 14. The fool multiplies his words. Now, I have also there in question 21, Matthew chapter 6. This is in the Lord's Sermon on the Mount. That was a study we had recently here on Tuesday mornings. Matthew 6 and verse 7. Talking about the three ways that one might show his righteousness in this context, 1 through 18 of Matthew 6. His charity, his charity, his prayers, and his fasting. Verse 7, what did Jesus count or caution about praying? Yeah, he says, do not use vain repetitions as the heathen do. What do they think? They will be heard for their many words. They think, the more I say, the better I'll be. Somewhere along the line, I'll get something right if I just fill the air with my speech. And the Lord says, no, that's not going to impress anybody. So it's not a matter, it's not quantity, what is it? It's quality. It's what it is, not how much it is. And so wisdom or foolishness will be evidenced by one's speech. And too often, men speak before thinking, don't they? Do we have any biblical examples of that very thing? Did I hear somebody give me a name? Jephthah? Well, okay, that was a rash vow. How about in the New Testament? I think of Peter. How often did Peter just blurt something out so impetuously and, well, maybe it wasn't that bad, but it was a lot. And I would imagine as an aged apostle inspired to write what he did, how often he must have thought back and I wish I hadn't said that, because I know I do that to myself and I'm hardly an inspired man. So too often man will speak before he thinks. And that how he speaks will show either his wisdom or his foolishness. And I think that's really what Solomon's saying. So verses 12 through 14, again in this overall context of whether we're wise or foolish, we need to even be careful of our speech and watch what we say. All right. This is the last part of verse 14, and this is the caution Solomon gives. Fools forget one important thing about their speech. What's the thing that he emphasizes in the last part of verse 14? That's right. And so, how often will a fool speak about things he knows nothing about? A lot. And the wise man knows, you know, I could offer a comment about that, but I really don't know what's going to happen. So no one knows what's going to happen. And it's foolish to speak about things in a certain way when you don't have the foggiest idea what's going to happen. No one knows. How many times in our studies in this book has Solomon in one way or the other stressed the uncertainty of the future? It's been several references. Well, he's made that point one way or another. And again, he makes it here regarding one's speech. So the last part of verse 14 of chapter 10 emphasizes it yet again. No man knows what will happen, and no one, and who can tell him what will come after him. All right? So there he is cautioning about speech in verse 14. Now look at verse 15. We go from back from speech, it seems, to actions again. Toil. My version has, in verse 15, the toil of a fool, or the labor, the actions of a fool, so wearies him, how he involves himself in his activities, that what happens? As Solomon writes it in verse 15. He doesn't even know where to go. Alright, the fool doesn't even know how to go to a city. Now, who ought to know how to go to a city? It's not a secret city. Most ways to a city are often labeled with signs, aren't they? So who should know how to go to a city? Anybody that can read. I think what he's referencing here is a failure to do even the most obvious of activities. The fool can't even do that. We have a modern-day equivalent, don't we? He doesn't even know how to come out of the rain. Someone who doesn't have any common sense. Sometimes, you know, we say things like that. And I think that's a modern-day equivalent. And that describes the fool. He's so consumed by his foolishness and his folly, he has such a lack of common sense, and can't even do the simplest of matters. And I think we see that in a lot of people. And that seems to be what he's talking about here, at least through verse 15. Okay. This gets us now to question 23, and it takes us to the... we're going to look at verses 16 through 20 together as a section to complete the 10th chapter. So, again, talking about wisdom and folly or foolishness, he's been emphasizing at least through verse 15 how it affects people individually. And that's correct and proper. But now it's going to be applied to affecting... just an individual? No, an entire land in a collective sense. All right. Angela, read for us, please. Ecclesiastes 10, 16 through 20. Okay. Well, let's look at how he emphasizes the value of wisdom and the tragedy, if I can use that word, of foolishness. What's the woe he pronounces first upon the land? Woe to you, land, if what? All right, if your king is a lad or a child, a boy. Well, have there been boy kings in the Scripture? There had. One as little as, what, 8 years old became king of Israel. Now, obviously he had to have some help, didn't he? You can't, what's the old phrase, you can't send a boy to do a man's job, so to speak. So I think what he's saying here is that his youth and his inexperience will be a hindrance to the land. And sometimes the land will have a very inexperienced leader. And look at all the problems that happen because of that. And then he also says, and woe to the land whose princes feast in the morning. Now, what's wrong with feasting in the morning? It's not the proper time to do that. What do you think is being emphasized by that phrase? Woe to the land whose princes feast in the morning. The idea is, I think, centered on the feast. Yeah, they're not just eating breakfast. They're indulging themselves benefits of their position. They're princes. They can do that. They're they're indulging themselves at the expense and the detriment of those that they lead and serve. Are there leaders who do that? Even nowadays, right? They get put in high, powerful positions of leadership, and they focus more on how they can benefit themselves and their own coffers rather than leading and being an example and serving those who sent them there to work and to serve. So, woe to the land who is in that kind of a position. Now, rather or opposite this gets us to verse 17. What's the blessing now? Woe in verse 16, blessing in verse 17. Blessed is the land who what? Oh, I forgot something. Many commentators think that Solomon is referring to his son Rehoboam. There's no proof that this is so, but if we consider it just for a moment, turn back to 1 Kings chapter 12, and then we'll get to verse 17. It fits. You're right, Brother Lambert. It fits. Now, when Solomon's writing this, he hadn't died yet, obviously, but I have no problem believing he would have been inspired to this. God certainly would have known what was going to happen. Solomon's dead. Rehoboam's king. Who was it that came to him? And let's not forget who the lead spokesman was in the group. Well, but who was their spokesman? It was Jeroboam, wasn't it? Jeroboam, whom God would use when the kingdom was split. And so he leads this contingent of men to the king. And just for sake of time, what was their basic request? Yeah, he's up on us. Indication from this request that Solomon had been a little rough, a little tough in his later years. He was not as wise or as compassionate a king as when he was when he started. But he'd been sort of rough, taxing him heavily. And the request was, listen, Rehoboam, if you back off, now that's what we get. What will you get? Yeah, you'll have our allegiance. We'll be loyal to you. We'll serve you. And we'll be behind you. And Rehoboam said, well, give me 3 days and I'll think about it. And to his credit, did Rehoboam consult good counsel? He did. Who was the first group he went to? In fact, the ones who had served who? Solomon. So if you look at their answer, it seems to indicate that they didn't approve of the decisions that Solomon had made in his reign. Because they told Rehoboam, what these men are asking is a good thing. You need to grant that request and you'll have their loyalty. But, see, he's a lad. And whether he didn't like that answer or he wanted to just get all his information before he made his decision, but at any respect, he chose to listen or he chose to ask another group. And these were very wise, experienced men, weren't they? They didn't know any more than he did. They were his age. And as youthful inexperience always wants to do, it wants to make its own mark. And they told Rehoboam what? You tell them if you thought Solomon was bad, you hadn't been anything yet. In fact, my little finger is what? Be thicker than his waist. There's a new sheriff in town now, and you're going to have to really get in line now. And who'd Rehoboam side with? He chose the second group. And so again, I like what Brother Lambert said. I can't prove that Solomon is thinking about that, but it certainly fits. And the point that he's making here in Ecclesiastes 10. The land will have nothing but trouble when inexperienced leaders are brought to her forefront and making decisions that they're just not qualified to make. They don't have experience on their side. Not that young people cannot contribute some good to the affairs of a house or a state, but to put them in the prime position of leadership is not a recipe for success. And I think this passage would certainly speak against that. Okay, now the blessing, the other point. What's he say? Blessed is the land whose what? Whose king is of nobility. Is that what your version said, Angela? The son of nobility. All right. Nobility seems to be talking about he has honor, he has served honorably, he has served with experience, he knows how the game is to be played. And if you have a wise, experienced leader, he doesn't get flustered when problems happen. He's been down that road before. He's able to deal with them. And so in that kind of situation, blessed is that lamb. And then what else does he say about the lamb besides the king? And blessed is the lamb whose prince is what? Feast at the right time. Yeah, they feast at the appropriate time. They eat not just for self-indulgence, but for strength, out of necessity. The wise men will know, get up first thing in the morning, okay, what can I do to please myself? That's the first group there in verse 16. Verse 17 is the group, all right, what will be best for those that I'm serving? I'll worry about myself later. I've got to take care of them first. Is that not true the same in the home? What if a man who leads his house, he has a wife, he has children, what if all he ever thinks about is himself? Isn't it the same principle? It is. It's entirely the same principle. In fact, he comes in what place? Not first. He's last. He comes last. He has others who depend upon him, and he does what he can for them. And this is the same thing, just on a much bigger scale, politically speaking. Okay. Now look at verses 18 through 19. And I think we're talking here about a political house or a national house. Any house needs constant attention, whether it's your literal house or the national house. And lack of such attention results in disaster. The points that he's making in these two verses could be applied to your literal home that you own. What if you never give it any attention whatsoever? What's eventually going to happen? It's going to gutter's going to fall off, roof will sag, walls will leak, all those things will happen. But I think if we look at the context, he's talking about the political house or the national house. He's talking about government, if you will, and in that case, that's how we'll approach these verses. All right. In verse 18, mine says, through indolence, and I think you said through slothfulness that you read, Angela, sloth. Indolence, slothfulness means sluggishness, laziness, not being attentive. The infrastructure of the national house will collapse through laziness. And the failure to identify and fix problem areas correctly. And I'm emphasizing the word correctly because I think the way verse 19 concludes gives us a lot to talk about just on a pragmatic basis or a practical basis. Many times solutions are chosen that don't really address the problem, right? The National House thinks, well, look at all the good that we're doing with all this stuff, and it's not really addressing the problem. In fact, how does verse 19 conclude? Now, let's just throw money at the problem. And that's not going to solve anything. As you read that verse and thought about, maybe your mind didn't think like mine did with respect to this. This is the end of question 24. Do you see any lessons for our for our current national house that fit this verse? All right, yeah, we got to raise taxes, got to get more money in to take care of all these. But is there any specific thing you can think of where the government has thrown money at a social problem, and it doesn't do one thing to fix it? Welfare comes to mind. Okay, bailing out financial institutions recently. What about a social problem? Let's pick one. Teen pregnancy is a social problem. Promiscuous teenagers who are hopping in and out of beds, committing fornication, and clearly. Well, in the first place, it goes against the Scripture, but we're going beyond that. It's a social blight and a plague upon our culture. Well, okay. We've got to do something about this, the government says. We can't have out here, you know, kids, babies having babies, as the old saying goes. So, what did the government decide to do to help fix that? Well, they threw money at it, and what did they put in high schools? Condom machines. Now, that's not going to fix the problem. In fact, rather than stop the fornication, what does that do? It encourages it. It tells them, well, if you're going to do it, then here's how to do it the right way. Yeah, and they won't let you teach. Hey, that's right, Sister Pepper, you're right. So, see, that's an example of the stupidity. when a national house just throws money at a problem. I'm not trying to get too preachy about this, but I mean, it's easy to see where Solomon, what he's saying is, it happens in our very current culture. You ever heard this thing called midnight basketball? You know what that's about? That was meant, or that was devised under President Clinton. Janet Reno was the Attorney General. That was her brainchild. It was meant to solve juvenile delinquency. Let's build basketball courts, and they can play ball under supervision, of course, even up through the wee hours of the morning. Now, how's that going to solve juvenile delinquency problems? I'm not going to do one thing to fix that. Well, that's right. But see, we just throw billions and billions of dollars at these problems, and they don't do one thing to address those issues. Mm-hmm. I think so. Right. Yes, that's right. And the mindset with those who adopt this approach is that they feel better because of all that they're doing that they feel like addresses these problems. And what Solomon is saying is that a land who has root princes or rulers who adopt this mindset, just use the words from verses 16 or 17. Is that land going to be woe to that land, or blessed be that land? Which one is it? Well, it's not blessed. It's a tragedy. It's a terrible problem. Okay, well, our time is up. I think we can stop right here. No need to go any further. This gets us toward the end of question 24. So, Lord willing, we'll pick up next Tuesday with question 25. We'll sort of conclude this discussion here at chapter 10, then we'll forge on ahead into chapter 11. Thank you for your good comments and your participation today.